Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
From WNYC Studios, I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Monday, March 4th. Good morning, everyone, on this Monday before Super Tuesday. Why do they call it Super Tuesday? Because the following states will hold their primaries tomorrow. Are you ready? Here we go. Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, California, Colorado, Maine, Massachusetts, Minnesota, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Vermont, and Virginia. I memorized that. No, I didn't. And which one does not belong? American Samoa, the only place that's not a state, will also vote. 15 out of the 50 states, plus the one territory, all tomorrow, Super Tuesday. And you would think there would be more at stake for the challenger, Donald Trump, right, who's losing 30-40% to Nikki Haley in state after state, not for President Joe Biden, who's got no competitive opponent. But there may actually be more at stake for the president tomorrow. Why? Well, back in December, Biden said this about the Israeli assault on Gaza. It has most of the world supporting it, but they're starting to lose that support by the indiscriminate bombing that takes place, Biden said in December. Now the same thing may be true of him. As things in Gaza get worse and worse, especially for Biden not threatening to cut off the military aid that enables the war, the way the war is being fought. So this isn't just Netanyahu's war, it's Biden's war too, as far as more and more people are concerned, with the tens of thousands of deaths plus starvation and desperation afflicting nearly all 2 million Gazans and getting worse. So you know that 100,000 people in the Michigan primary voted uncommitted rather than vote for Biden last week. Tomorrow could be an important test of how much power the uncommitted movement has. So while Biden is seen by many as doing nothing to stop the way the war is being fought, even how justified it may have been from the start because of the horrible October 7th attack by Hamas, maybe this is why Vice President Harris spoke in the strongest terms yet about the situation in a speech she gave yesterday.
And the Israeli government must do more to significantly increase the flow of aid. No excuses. They must open new border crossings. They must not impose any unnecessary restrictions on the delivery of aid. They must ensure humanitarian personnel, sites, and convoys are not targeted. And they must work to restore basic services and promote order in Gaza so more food, water, and fuel can reach those in need.
Vice President Harris in Selma, Alabama yesterday. Let's talk about how it's Biden versus Netanyahu and Biden versus uncommitted now with NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid, also the co-host of the NPR Politics podcast and a seasoned campaign reporter for before she took the White House beat. So she's got expertise both ways on this Super Tuesday week. Asma, I know you've got 15 states plus American Samoa to keep your eye on tomorrow. So thanks for squeezing in some one-on-one time for WNYC today. Welcome.
No, my pleasure to join you all. Thanks for having me.
The Kamala Harris speech is making news around the country and around the world. Do you see a relationship between the timing of the speech and the timing of tomorrow's vote?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think I see more of a relationship between the setting of where Harris delivered this speech and the words that she spoke. We have seen from the White House, I think, an increasing frustration, both privately and some of it has spilled out publicly, with how Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's leader, has been conducting the war in Gaza. But, you know, notably where the vice president spoke yesterday was in Selma, Alabama, on the anniversary of Bloody Sunday. We have seen some reports that a number of African-American leaders, church leaders, have grown very frustrated with what's been going on in Gaza. And they see a human rights, civil rights comparison to the way that many, you know, black folks have been treated for years here in the United States with the way the Palestinians are being treated. I would say both in Gaza, but also to some degree in the West Bank. And then more recently also, you had a number of bishops from the AME, the historical AME Church, who issued a letter calling for the United States to halt funding for Israel. And so, you know, these are very bold moves, I would argue, by a key constituency of the Democratic Party. And I think there was a lot of an early assumption, that the Michigan concerns were largely limited to Arab voters, to Arab American voters, to Muslim voters. And there is, I think, a concern about the concerns about Gaza potentially spilling over to young voters, black voters, and other key parts of the Democratic base.
Yeah. Why do you think they sent out the vice president to give that speech rather than the president himself? He can sound that strong and passionate when he wants to, as we know, as he has on a few other occasions recently.
You know, I did a story a little while back about why President Biden has been hugging Netanyahu so closely. And I think a lot of this goes back to his long personal relationship, both with the country of Israel and then also with Netanyahu. Harris, I would argue, is more skeptical of Netanyahu in particular. We've seen, I think, very public remarks that differ a little bit on the margins, right? I mean, the vice president's office and the president's office often try to point out that there's no daylight. But if I go back to her comments in Dubai on the outskirts of this big climate conference, the tone was different. And, you know, I think when you talk about Biden, he has had a long personal relationship. And the politics domestically on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict have to some degree shifted, I would argue, evolved within the Democratic Party. And Joe Biden, and I hear this from many, particularly younger Democratic voters, feels a bit stuck in time in the 1990s. And, you know, when I talk to people who know Biden, who've worked for Biden, this is a very personal, emotional issue. He feels deeply, I think, bothered, of course, by what happened, the horrific attack on October 7th. But you saw him go to Israel and quite, you know, literally hug Netanyahu. And there was, I think, some concern within some Democratic circles that prior to what happened on October 7th, this administration had deep concerns about Netanyahu's commitment to democracy. So you ask, why the vice president? I would argue that tonally, she has had a bit of a different message. But secondly, this White House, this administration sees the vice president as the whisperer to communities of color, whether that's, you know, black voters, Latino communities, but also certainly young voters. And beyond this issue of Gaza, you see her meet extensively with, you know, a college campus tour. You've seen her talk to a number of black and Latino conventions last summer. That has been her role, particularly as we're heading closer into that November 2024 re-election campaign.
Interesting. One more clip from Harris's speech, because the U.S. does still acknowledge that Hamas has responsibility for what happens next here, too. You'll hear how this starts with the vice president, but you'll hear also how this ends.
Mm-hmm. And given the immense scale of suffering in Gaza, there must be an immediate ceasefire. Yeah. For at least the next 6 weeks, which is what is currently on the table. This will get the hostages out and get a significant amount of aid in. This would allow us to build something more enduring, to ensure Israel is secure, and to respect the right of the Palestinian people to dignity, freedom, and self-determination. Hamas claims it wants a ceasefire. Well, there is a deal on the table.
So she's calling for an immediate ceasefire, but mm-hmm. not the permanent ceasefire that the protest movement calls for, because that's seen by the U.S. as giving Hamas too much of a permanent victory in this war when they promise more attacks. And she ends the clip by saying, Hamas knows there's a temporary ceasefire and prisoner and hostage exchange deal on the table. They have to accept it. So my question for you as a White House correspondent is, if the U.S. is pressuring Israel to say yes, which it hasn't either, does the mm-hmm. Biden administration have a partner who's closer to Hamas pressuring them?
No, I mean, the Biden administration, like I would say many previous U.S. administrations, doesn't have a direct line to Hamas. And so you've seen intermediaries, both in Qatar and in Egypt, talk to Hamas officials. And that's the go-between. The United States certainly has a much closer direct line to pressure the Israeli government, to pressure Netanyahu. But I would argue broadly, I mean, you look today, you've got a member of Israel's war cabinet, Benny Gantz, who's here in Washington, going to be meeting with the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, going to be meeting with Vice President Harris. And I do think that there is a desire to separate out the Israeli people from the current Israeli government that you hear in this Biden administration. But, you know, I want to go back to one thing you said earlier, which was the VP's comments about a ceasefire for at least 6 weeks. This is arguably the Biden administration's position. It is no different, you know, in terms of what she articulated than what we heard, I believe, Joe Biden articulate some weeks ago when he spoke when the King of Jordan visited Washington, D.C. The difference, again, though, I would say, is a matter of tone. I mean, when I've spoken to Arab American voters, one of their big concerns has been that you have this man in Joe Biden who is known as a kind of empathizer in chief, who really talks about feeling other people's pain. And they have felt consistently throughout this conflict that while the president very much humanized Israelis who lost their lives on October 7th, he has somewhat struggled, they felt, to articulate the same degree of humanity and empathy for, you know, this now about 30,000 Palestinians who've lost their lives. And so, you know, I think what we heard, again, going back to Harris, I mean, there was a degree, I think, of detail in how she spoke about Palestinian lives that we don't really hear from President Biden very often. Mm-hmm. She spoke about some people needing to resort to eating animal feed, malnourished babies. There's a degree of vividness in the stories. And that is something I've routinely heard from Arab American voters, mm-hmm. is that there is a degree that these are just mass casualties and that there's no human face behind what's going on in Gaza right now.
And Michigan, which had its primary last week, of course, has a large percentage of Arab and Muslim voters, including in the Democratic primary, as compared with other states. Is tomorrow a test of how powerful the dissent on Biden's Gaza policy is for a wider spectrum of the Democratic base that might vote uncommitted in multiple states?
You know, I don't see it particularly that way. I do think that the uncommitted vote we saw in Michigan was, to some degree, demographically unique. There is a sizable population of Arab American voters, many of whom are Muslim, but not all. I think it's upwards of 200,000, and they really could help potentially swing an election one way or the other in that state of Michigan. It was a campaign that I believe started about 3 weeks prior to the primary election itself in Michigan. You know, I think the bigger test tomorrow, if I'm speaking really candidly here, is on the Republican side. There is a sense that after Super Tuesday, there will be, I think, a solidified Republican frontrunner. And the Biden campaign believes that once many voters see that Donald Trump is the likely presumptive Republican nominee, this idea of a contrast and choosing between Biden and Trump will, to some degree, solidify, they believe, in voters' minds. And their thinking is that, you know, in the case of some Arab American and Muslim voters, even if they are not fully on board with how the president has handled the war in Gaza, that once they see that Donald Trump is on the other side, they'll come home to the Democratic Party. I have some reservations about that theory, in part because I do think there is deep anger and frustration that I've not seen. And I've covered many campaigns. I've not seen this in many, many years. And I don't think it's solely limited to Muslim voters or Arab American voters. There are many young voters who are frustrated. And this goes beyond the conflict in the Middle East. They're frustrated about, you know, economic issues, not being able to afford certain things. They're frustrated with the lack of student loan debt forgiveness, which, of course, the president has tried, but that was stopped to some degree in the Supreme Court. And I think that the administration, and we'll see this on Thursday with the president's State of the Union address, has really struggled to articulate how certain economic policies, how certain broad policies relate to people's lives. And I think that this and the president's weakness is much deeper than the conflict in the Middle East.
We have a few minutes left with NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid. A lot of you who just tuned in say, I know that voice. I know that voice from NPR. It's Asma Khalid. What is she doing on WNYC's local show? Well, she's giving us a few minutes this morning, good enough to do that. And we have just a few minutes of those minutes left. And I'm glad you brought up Trump in that last answer, because I don't know if you've seen it yet, but we have some breaking presidential campaign news just in the last few minutes. And listeners, heads up, because a lot of you have been waiting for this. Just in from the Supreme Court, Colorado is one of the states that votes on Super Tuesday tomorrow. And the Supreme Court just handed down a ruling moments ago that strikes down Colorado's state Supreme Court, removing Donald Trump from the ballot there. The Colorado court had determined that Trump disqualified himself by violating the insurrection clause of the U.S. Constitution, but SCOTUS said no. And Asma, it was 9-0 on the court, 9-0, restoring Trump to the ballot, not just in Colorado, but on any other state that was in the process of doing that. And there were a few. Reaction to that, and since you cover the White House, does this ruling affect how Biden campaigns in any way?
I would say I don't think it's a particularly surprising decision based on how and what we saw from the court earlier. I think there was a general assessment that this is the way the court would rule. Look, I think that it further cements the inevitable reality that many of us who've been covering politics for a while have been saying, which is that this is not a normal election cycle. I know tomorrow we're going to focus a lot on Super Tuesday because a third of Republican delegates are at stake. But Donald Trump really has a stronghold on the current Republican Party. And no doubt Nikki Haley chips away a certain percent. You could argue whether it's, 25, 30, 40% in some states. But it's Donald Trump who has been winning primary after primary. I would argue that he will become very quickly the Republican nominee, likely quicker than he did even in years past. And that is because his campaign has been systematically working with a number of state parties to turn the rules, the delegate math, further in favor of Donald Trump. I think that this is not particularly surprising. It is the inevitable scenario of what many of us had expected. And look, now I think that we're going to see after Super Tuesday a shift towards a general election campaign in earnest. I don't know entirely what that means because I think both Donald Trump and Joe Biden have weaknesses amongst the coalitions of voters that they have depended on in the past. And we're going to spend the next several months looking at whether or not each candidate can actually put that coalition back together again.
Yeah, well said. So last question. Do you know where Biden will be tomorrow night as the returns come in from 15 states plus American Samoa? And do you expect a victory speech in prime time on the East Coast, or will we have to wait until California comes in?
For Biden, you're saying?
Correct.
Or for, yeah.
Well,
no,
either
I mean,
that you want to answer.
Yeah, I mean, I think really, I mean, this is a formality. Joe Biden is the incumbent president, right? And so we are going to see him after the State of the Union make some campaign stops. He'll be both, I believe, in Pennsylvania and Georgia. We'll also see the vice president visit some key swing states. But the focus this week is on the State of the Union. There is heavy expectation for what this president needs to accomplish, both in the delivery of the message, the content, but also how he says this and the need to quiet some of those concerns about his age. There is also, I think, correctly, an assessment from this White House that not all voters are going to view the State of the Union in the same way on television sitting down. They will see it in different ways, on different platforms, truncated in clips. And so there's been a deliberate effort to try to reach out to different kinds of people, whether it's content creators, regional news outlets. And I think that is this White House's primary focus this week, is that Thursday State of the Union address.
NPR White House correspondent and co-host of the NPR political podcast, Asma Khalid. Asma, again, thanks a lot for a few minutes on a very busy morning, day before Super Tuesday.
No problem.
Thank you very
much. No problem. Take care.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.